Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil.
Look at him there, sitting on the couch, pretending to care about the Bundesliga. Is that a slice of Black Forest gatto? It is. Oh, it doesn't get any more German than that.
This is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly morning to you.
Goodly morning to you too. Oh, a surprise to have a goodly morning today. What's the cause behind it?
Sunshine. Sunshine. The sun is shining. I was out with the dogs earlier on. It's really warm. It feels like summer, and to me it's always a bit of a surprise when we get some nice weather here in Ireland, so I am just delighted with the weather. I know there's an awful lot of other stuff going on in the world that we're not going to talk about because we're going to give people a bit of an escape from all that, but
sure.
The sunshine in and of itself provides me with enough goodliness to wish you a goodly morning.
Well, I'm very grateful. I think we could all do with a goodly morning before long. I also went out for a little walk before the podcast, and it is beautiful, even in England as well. So, I mean, maybe that is goodly in itself.
Yeah, maybe it is. So, we are going to talk about bits and pieces with regards to Arsenal, because there have been some developments.
I know.
Since the
real
last time.
Real life developments.
Real life footballing developments and things. And I was, I said this on Friday or Thursday when I was recording the podcast for Friday. I sort of, there was nothing going on. And then all of a sudden a load of stuff happened and a load of stuff went on, which would have lent itself to some good discussion in terms of Arsenal. But it was too late to really do anything on Friday. So we've got a fair bit to get through here. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the first thing is the fact that we know when football is coming back and we've got a date for our very first game. So,
yeah. I don't know about you, but when I was like, football's coming back. Oh, great. And then it was like, and it'll start with Arsenal going away to Manchester City. And I was like, oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I forgot we had to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it felt like things happened quite quickly, didn't it? Because, mm-hmm. Well, I think it was maybe Wednesday, and it was like they've all voted for a return to full training and they can have contact, you know, full contact training, et cetera, et cetera. And then the next day, it was like, well, here we go. Here's the first fixtures are out, and we're going to play Man City on the 17th of June. So, you know, it's not too long. It's June now. It's the 1st of June. We're just 16 days away from Arsenal playing football again. So, yeah, I mean, leaving aside the Manchester City thing, how do you feel about it?
A real mix of feelings, I have to say, actually. But I think I'll be really excited to watch my team play again and the players that I predominantly like and care about. And there will be a sort of reassuring familiarity, even in the kind of weird setting it's going to be. I'm excited to watch some football. I can't believe quite how much football is going to be available to watch.
Yeah.
Sort of extraordinary. I mean, certainly in the UK, I think pretty much everything is televised. Some things on free-to-air television, either via Sky or through the BBC. It's going to be unlike anything we've ever really seen before. Mm. And I think it will feel kind of self-contained. I feel like it will, it try as they might to kind of do a previously on the Premier League, I think everyone's basically forgotten. Do you know what I mean?
Actually, I've got a question about that, which I'll do a little bit later on. But yeah, okay. That's a great idea. Previously on the Premier League. Dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun. But the amount of catch-up you'd have to do you know what I mean? It'd be 90 minutes in itself.
Fucking hell. Could you imagine doing it for Arsenal? Could you imagine trying to do a previously on Arsenal 2019-20 and you start with this sort of summer of optimism when we all thought things were going to be good, you know, the transfer business and people people were a bit excited and enthused by that. And then the sort of slow, steady, inexorable decline of Unai Emery and the team playing poorly, and Freddie Ljungberg coming in, and just poor old Freddie sitting there with Per Mertesacker behind him and the tea lady, who was his only other member of staff, trying to figure it out. There was that great moment, wasn't there, at one point in one of the games. I can't remember who it was or who did something. And the camera just cut to Freddie on the sideline. He put his hands on his head and he's just looking like, what have you done? What are you? Are you a professional? I can't remember what it was, but it was probably some kind of defensive calamity. And Freddie, and then the whole Arteta thing happening, and then wow, yeah, it would take about 2 weeks to watch a previously on Arsenal.
Henrik Mkhitaryan played for Arsenal this season. That seems a long time ago.
That is mental, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's mental to think about.
This very same season we're about to recommence.
Yeah.
Henrik Mkhitaryan played for us. So I think that it will have kind of it will feel like a weird sort of mini tournament, I think, the Premier League, that's being played out. And I think it will be quite exciting in that respect. There'll be a bit of that sort of World Cup summer energy to it. Unfortunately, not the atmosphere.
The unknownness of it all, because we don't, previously we could, as a season goes on, you're sort of aware of what's happening and, form plays a part and the strength of a team and all of those sort of things give you an idea of what you more or less think is going to happen. And look, of course, you can be wrong and very often are wrong about the way certain games, certain performances turn out. But we're going into this off the back of an unprecedented event, which no manager, whether you're a rookie like Mikel Arteta, who's only managed, 10 games as a Premier League manager, or somebody like Roy Hodgson, who has had a long and storied career. He's been around Europe. He's, managed England. He has such a wealth of experience. He has never had to deal with anything like this. So I wonder, is there going to be like an equalization in some ways? Like, nobody really is going to have an advantage in this situation based on what they've done in the past. We may find that some managers come out of it well because they're able to think laterally, or they've got good medical staff or whatever it might be. And that, that will come out in the wash as the games are played. But the idea that we have literally no idea what the impact is going to be on players, clubs, teams, performances, and just the experience itself, lends itself to this kind of wide-eyed excitement, which I realize, in the grand scheme of things, and because of why it's happened, you probably shouldn't ignore that. But it is what it is from a sporting perspective.
Yeah, I think that there's probably going to be a bit more mobility in the table than there would otherwise be at this point in a season, in a traditional sense, because, you never know. You might have the team that is perfectly suited to this weird scenario. Or, like you say, the coach who is the perfect coach to have in a pandemic and you didn't even realise it this whole time. I don't know, but I do feel like it is harder to predict than it ordinarily is. The only sort of caveat I'd offer to that is that in Germany, from what I understand, the big teams have looked pretty comfortable for the most part. And it's almost like, in removing some of the vagaries of the season, it's almost like it's arrived at sort of greater objectivity and kind of, talent and the depth of squad is kind of outing. So that will be interesting too, to see if that kind of replicates in England.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's going to be super weird. And I don't really remember all the intricacies of kind of where we are in the table and what we need, but I kind of think that it's almost not that worth thinking about in a funny kind of way, because everything, it kind of feels like anything could happen,
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like, let's go back to March before any of this happened, and let's say we'd finished without European football. I think we would have been quite bothered by that, even if it was just, Europa
for
League,
sure,
right? And I do wonder, if we finish without European football this time, assuming that there is some European football to even happen, right? I think we're probably going to be a bit more sanguine about it because of the circumstances in which everything has taken place.
Absolutely. I mean, there are lots of different factors to that. So one is, you know, OK, if we don't qualify for Europe, we don't have any money. Well, guess what? No one's got any money anyway. If we don't qualify for Europe, we won't have European Games. Well, guess what? There might not be European Games next season, or certainly not in anything like the conventional form we're used to. And I also think above and beyond all that, there's kind of a greater sense of perspective, maybe. And who knows how long that lasts. But right now, I think people are sort of grateful to be... Well, they're grateful for a lot of things, but they're grateful to be watching their team in action more than necessarily worrying about where that is. I mean, who knows how long that will last?
Yeah, one game. One game.
I'd say one game. Pitchforks out.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, first defeat. Yeah. You know, we'll all be up in arms. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean by that. The stakes kind of feel reduced. I mean, I know that this is the end of the 2019-20 Premier League season. I recognise that.
Yeah.
But it in no way feels like it. It does sort of weirdly feel like a free hit. And let's be clear, for the teams that are relegated, it won't feel like that at all.
No.
It will be agonising for them. And I almost feel like we might be on the verge of another sort of Sheffield United crisis, you know, like when they went down and Carlos Tevez had been playing for West Ham and...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They appealed against it. West Ham, I think, had to pay damages. But, like, yeah, so it feels like we might end up in that sort of legal quagmire.
Maybe, but I think if the games are played, then...
You think surely they've come to an agreement prior. You've consented, ultimately.
Yeah, exactly. I think if you know, there had been an adjudication on the season, I think then it would have been a legal minefield. But actually playing the games is going to sort of do away with that to a certain extent. Like you say, all the games are going to be televised in the UK and Ireland. I know that in certain parts of the world, you know, you've got access to every game anyway. But for us, this is look, if you know how to do streaming, you've got access to every game anyway. But the simple task of sitting down and turning on your TV to watch football isn't always available to us. It will be in this particular setup, and that obviously makes a lot of sense because, you know, the confirmation that fans are not going to be allowed in the stadiums was not a surprise. But even just seeing it written down, it felt a bit stark, you know. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what sort of improved my mood about the season returning was last week. I don't know if you happened to see any of the Bayern Munich Dortmund game.
Last week?
Yeah, was it last week?
I think so.
Tuesday? 5 p.m. It was great. And, like, there was no crowd, of course, and no... But I think it would be wrong to say there was no atmosphere because there was such an intensity about the way the game was played. It almost had the feel of those sort of Galactico games, you know, from the Spanish League a few years ago. Just two great teams going toe-to-toe. And I recognise that's not the product we're going to get every single game in the Premier League. But it made me think, given that those are not teams that I particularly care about and the degree to which I was able to sort of invest and be interested in that match, it made me think, OK, I think this will work. I think, you know, the Premier League being back will be, for fans, a positive thing.
We had a load of questions, which I'm going to do here. I'll just give the people a shout out. Mark Charalambus, who's that, Mark? Chara, sorry, Mark, I've absolutely butchered your name. I know
Charalambus. I went to school with another Charalambus.
There you go. Thank you.
So
you saved my bacon.
There.
Okay, that's good. Mark says, with confirmation of the league set to continue, what will be our starting 11 versus Man City on the 17th of June? Daniel Keenan. Hi, both. Can you predict a starting 11 for City away now that football is back? He says, I know you love these. And Kid Large, who's at Kid_Heavy, says, starting 11 versus City? Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. He had a lot of question marks and in capitals. So I think he's very excited.
If there's ever a time to do this question, surely it's now.
Surely it's now when we have no information whatsoever on the state of the players' fitness or anything
like that. It's complete speculation.
Are we assuming,
Yes.
And would we be right to assume that, let's say, bar someone like Lucas Torreira, who is coming back from a serious injury, the ankle break that he sustained, like everyone else is going to be fit, assuming like they don't get a, you know, a hamstring strain in training, et cetera, et cetera.
Which can happen.
Can happen. And probably,
I mean,
will.
I fell down my stairs yesterday, Andrew. Anything could happen.
Well, this is a good omen. This is a good omen for the return of football.
True.
James fell down. You didn't hurt yourself too badly, I hope.
No, my knee was making some weird noises afterwards, but it seems fine today.
Right.
So all I'm saying is, you know, let's hope our players avoid injury in similar circumstances. But I think you're right. I mean, we haven't had any injury updates, have we, in this period? We've not had, like, on Arsenal.com a thing saying, like, yeah, we think everyone's fine.
Yeah.
They're at home. They've got repetitive strain injuries from playing too many computer games.
I like that one. Yeah, like squad news. Everyone being assessed ahead of Man City.
Yeah. but I think we can assume that people will be fit. I mean, obviously Callum Chambers, Lucas Torreira, there are people with some long-term concerns, but everyone else should be in contention. I mean, I think even Torreira is probably not that far away at this point.
No, I mean, his season-ending injury has been transformed into, like...
A season-beginning injury.
Season-beginning injury, yeah. So
with a nice big rest in the run-up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think let's operate on the idea that everyone's kind of available.
Let's do that, then.
Okay, so Bernd Leno's going to be in goal, because no one will remember, of course, but Bernd Leno was quite good this season.
Yes. He's a good goalkeeper, or he has been a good goalkeeper.
Blocked it out, but there was a period where we were entirely dependent on Bernd Leno for any kind of defensive respite. So you'd go for him. You'd go for Hector Bellerin at right back, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
With his shorn head.
Yes.
Shaved. Don't know what the right word is there.
Shaved, yeah.
Shaved. Freshly shorn,
freshly shaven head.
Then it gets tricky,
I think,
in defence. Because when previously on the
Arsenal
Premier League, Bukayo Saka was good, wasn't he, at left back?
Yes, he was.
But we have two other left backs, one of whom, Kieran Tierney, is presumably fit.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. His shoulder injury is...
His shoulder
well
has been reattached.
Yep.
His arm is back on.
It's always
ready
good
to go. But is he ready? Do you know what I mean? Is he game ready? I think that's... Well, nobody's game ready.
That's it.
But
we're all equal here, so...
Yeah. I still... What do you think he'll do at left back?
I kind of think he will go with Tierney. And again, this is based on no evidence... I just wonder if, you know...
Well, he
if
was
we're
nice
in
about him in an interview,
he was.
He?
Said he was a very nice young man and a good player, etc., etc. I just have a feeling that the Saka situation as a whole is one that he might be cognizant of in the sense that, you know, the contract thing is a thing, right?
Mm.
Does Saka want to be a left back? I think he might want to play further forward, even if he is and has been very good at left back. So does that play a part in how you set up your team going forward? Like, there are levels, aren't there? Like, could this be the last nine games of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang's time at Arsenal? If it is, do you play him on the left wing or do you play him as a striker where he's best? You know? So maybe you play Tierney, and on the left-hand side of your attack, you put in Saka, and you look at those two as perhaps a foundation for the future. Two guys who could work together very well. Tierney likes to get forward. We know that Saka is good going forward, but also pretty good defensively as well. So those two, if this is what you're trying to do, you got a free hit, and you can put everything in, start putting the pieces together in place for the long term. Maybe that's what you do.
I think that's very sound logic. I have no logic to back up my argument.
Okay.
But I think my... I think that that would be a good thing to do. My gut says that maybe Saka carries on at left back.
Right.
Just a feeling based on sort of like a desperate attempt to kind of get some kind of continuity from what was working when football stopped. But I would definitely think that in the long term, Tierney would be a more interesting selection. So let's say it's our team, isn't it? So let's say Tierney.
Okay. All right.
What about centre-backs? Well, it was sort of Luiz and Mustafi when we left it, wasn't it?
It was, and I kind of have a feeling that is going to be the case again.
Yeah, I think the only other contender is Pablo Mari, isn't he?
Yes. Yes.
But I think that... Yeah, I think it'll be Mustafi and Luiz. I mean, again, you could make an argument that in the long term, Mari is a more appropriate selection.
Yeah, yeah.
In some ways, especially if you're possibly losing David Luiz, because they're both more comfortable really on the left-hand side.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange one. We're going to have we'll talk about the Luiz thing in a few minutes. But yeah, look, he does have an option there. He does have Pablo Mari. He also has Socrates, Rob Holding as well, a contender. So he's got options
big,
there.
Big game for Pablo Mari.
Would be against his former club,
technically
yeah.
A Man City player.
Yes.
I think I would err on the side of Luiz and Mustafi, incredibly. Would you go Pablo Mari?
I can understand why Arteta might go with that.
Sure.
It's not necessarily
you can't,
a choice.
Good conscience, do
yeah,
it.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. I couldn't advocate for that myself, but I can understand why Arteta might, particularly, you know, in against a team like City, with quick players and everything else. What's your midfield then? I mean, I'm assuming a midfield three.
Like well, I think it will be similarly. Well, if we've gone with Tierney at left back, then Saka's going to be on the left. I mean, I think Xhaka will play for
yep.
sure.
Yep.
I think maybe Dani Ceballos will play.
I'd sort of thought about a Xhaka, Guendouzi, Ceballos midfield because I, you know, Mesut Ozil away against Man City.
I know, but he does tend to pick Ozil.
Yeah,
he
does. Yeah, he does. But you know, there's all this evidence and stuff.
Sure, but you know, you scientists with your evidence and your data,
with your facts.
Yeah,
we don't need.
I'm absolutely sick of it.
We don't need experts.
What about... Because we basically know, right, that if we've picked Saka left wing, we're probably going to pick Aubameyang up front and probably Pepe on the right-hand side.
I had Pepe down, but, you know, I'm sort of in this... I feel like, you know, somebody like Reece Nelson might be in with a shout.
Sure. Martinelli.
Martinelli, maybe not so much. Because I think he's just more of a... He's more of a free spirit in the attacking third. Whereas if you're looking for structure from a team, maybe he could pick Reece Nelson because he has done in the past. And if you're looking for somebody to, you know, support Hector Bellerin, maybe that might be the way to go.
Yeah. And Pepe's a really interesting player to have up your sleeve in the old five subs game, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he can change a game. He does have that ability.
Yeah.
And then, so you were thinking a three in midfield and no Mesut Ozil, potentially. Well, Guendouzi, was it last season? Guendouzi was really excellent away to Man City.
I've sort of wiped last season from my memory.
Sure, so. I mean, we were babies when last season happened. I don't know. But I seem to recall he was kind of our best player in that game. I don't think we got anything, obviously. But
no.
I'd be all for that. I mean, I think when we talk about central midfield, I think it becomes sort of quite quickly apparent that that is the most problematic area of the pitch for this team.
Yeah, I mean, without Torreira being fit, you know, who you could see as a good fit in a game away at Man City, you know, with the kind of qualities and the attributes that he has, I don't think he's going to be ready for Man City away. Maybe.
I think they've just, you know, I'd be surprised. I mean, but yeah, you know, you mentioned Xhaka and he's been good under Arteta, but we know there are plenty of objections to him from that section of the fan base. Ceballos, kind of good, but sort of not really been consistent enough. And Guendouzi, very young and prone to inconsistency as well as a consequence.
Mm.
So that's the area that it'll be in some ways most interesting to see what Arteta does, because he's been very wedded to this particular shape now, which has been, you know, with Ozil as a kind of 10, Aubameyang from the left, Lacazette dropping in as a centre forward and someone holding their position on the right. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not he persists with that.
Yeah, or whether, you know, there might be a surprise selection with a young player or something like that. So.
Yeah, and also, how much does he know about Manchester City? You know, when he might think, well, I know what they do so well that I know a tactic that can counteract it and therefore will implement something specific. A bit like he did when he coached Manchester City against Arsenal and he was able to sort of say, you know, this is how you take them apart, and they did.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I'm excited and I'm intrigued to see which way it goes for sure. And weirdly, I mean, look, there's never a good time to play Man City. They are a really good team, but it feels like there's a kind of a random element to this particular meeting. You know, it's the first game. No one really knows what shape anybody's in. No one can sort of quite figure out how motivated people will be. I mean, Man City arguably are in this sort of weird position where they're restarting a season where they sort of know they won't win it. They also sort of know they're going to be in the top four. You know, it could suit us. It could suit us.
Yeah, I mean, if there is, I'm not saying there's a good time or this is a good time, because both teams will have had their issues with fitness and being physically ready. And you know, when you mention Germany and you say the big teams have come through pretty well in the opening weeks of the Bundesliga, you know, City are a big team and they have maybe the quality, the overall quality to deal with it better than we do. You know, it might take us a little bit of time to sort of get up to speed. Equally, you know, the same might apply to Man City, and we could have a good day and they might have an off day, as is, you know, could be the case anyway. So, yeah, we just have no idea. Anyway, it'll be very interesting to hear, I assume, from Mikel Arteta and from the manager about the squad and the team over the coming days. I would imagine we'll hear something this week. No, just... just for the sake of some hashtag content, if you like, now that everybody's back in full training, some observations on how it's going wouldn't go amiss.
I mean, I can tell you from my perspective, you know, we don't know as journalists what kind of access we'll have. Like, you know, there's not been any talk yet about press conferences or getting into games, stuff like that. But I imagine surely the club will do some sort of internal interview with Mikel sooner rather than later. It'd be fascinating to hear from them, because all we've got to go on at the moment is sort of Stu's pictures, isn't it, from training. And it's great to see. I mean, I've loved how excited everyone's been just at training pictures. You know, it's like pre-season ramped up, isn't it, in terms of how people are reacting to that stuff.
Yeah. The other thing I guess that we'll find out this week is the rest of the fixture schedule, because if they've arranged the first couple of games and haven't announced the rest, you would assume that this week we will get some clarity on the fixtures, when and, you know, where they're going to take place, because there are some talks about games being played at neutral venues. And I know that perhaps the Merseyside derby is one that they earmarked. And I think the North London derby, which was due to take place at the Toilet Bowl, is one of those games that they're talking about having at a neutral venue. So I think the clubs are pretty much opposed to that, aren't they?
They are. I think a lot of it surrounds Liverpool and them winning the league and the feeling that that might prompt street parties and things like that. I mean, I have to say, whether that game is played in at Anfield or at Villa Park or wherever it might be, surely the chances of people being out on the streets of Liverpool celebrating are kind of roughly the same. I don't know that having the game somewhere else necessarily prevents congregation of people. Do you know what I mean?
No, of course not. Of course not. It might prevent congregation of people around the stadium, but you know, I feel like if and when Liverpool win the title, their fans are going to take to the streets. You know, they're not going to be in the pubs, but I think we've seen over the last number of days, and certainly with some of the things that have gone on, the idea of lockdown, and I, you know, it's kind of gone to a large extent. And from what I understand, that from today, is it, measures in the UK are being
relaxed? Yeah, relaxed. I mean, today in the UK, I think you can meet outside in a group of six people if you're 2 meters away from each other. But I think what's happened kind of politically has sort of undermined the lockdown, if you see what I mean. So I think it's not being upheld with anything like the rigour that it was. And also, it'll be interesting to see, like, it's very easy to say June 17th and we can all look at that and go, well, right now that feels feasible. But then if you're talking about these fixtures running to like end of July or August, at that point, you're really dependent on things continuing to get better for quite a sustained period of time. And actually, you know, that's not sort of medically or scientifically guaranteed. So it'll be tricky for them to kind of unfold that full schedule, because there can be no guarantees, essentially, that it will be met.
Yeah.
I have to say, I was a bit disappointed that the FA Cup, plans for the FA Cup, aren't for the little mini tournament playoff-style thing at the end of the season.
That is a bit of a shame. Yeah, we've got a game against Sheffield United. We've got a date for that one, end of June. It's 26th or 27th?
27th or 28th, I believe.
Right.
And then mid-July for the semi-finals. Final on the 1st of August seems to be the plan. So, you know, we are looking roughly, if things continue and, you know, rates of infection keep going down, at finishing the season at the start of August and probably starting it again, I don't know, certainly in September.
Well, I mean, they couldn't realistically take another long break, could they? Having had no real physical work at all for a couple of months. And I know that players have been doing their bits and pieces and doing their treadmills and doing their weights and all that kind of stuff. But the idea of like this enforced 3 month break from football, you finish the season in a clutch of games, you're not going to send the guys off. Nobody's going anywhere on holidays anyway, are they? You know, so you're not going to give them another 4 to 6 week break like you would have done previously. I just feel like it's going to start again pretty quickly. So if the FA Cup, are we assuming the FA Cup is the final game of the domestic season?
I think so. That's the plan, the sort of climax of the season. I think I'm right in saying that there were mooted dates for European finals. Not that that's something Arsenal need to worry about at this point, around a similar kind of time. So that's the plan. That is the plan, that will play out this season across June and July, and then there'll be a few week gap and football will be back. But I think, I mean, once the Premier League is back up and running and Project Restart is kind of in action, there'll have to be a whole other set of conversations about the parameters for next season.
Yeah.
And I understand why that's sort of been on the back burner while they try and resolve this season, because there are all kinds of financial imperatives that mean they need to do so. But, yeah, next season's a whole other challenge, isn't it?
It sure is. Sure is. And look, you know, we'll be in a better position to think about that and to make decisions and everything else. You know, when we've gone through this round of games, when football does begin again, because there'll be a lot to learn from how it happens, how it goes down. And I think what I'm curious about is how fans will react. And by fans, I mean the sort of match-going fans, to being excluded. Because, you know, I thought about this over the weekend. You know, for those of us who watch the majority of our games on television. The only real problem for us is the fact that fans aren't in the ground. Therefore, there's no atmosphere, there's no cheering, unless, of course, they introduce the... Did I read somewhere today they were going to bring in, like, the sound effects from FIFA 20?
I think that was mooted somewhere. Yeah. I know that with the German games, some of the US broadcasters have been doing crowd noise. And apparently, very successfully. I mean, a couple of people tweeted me saying, I thought this would be awful.
Yeah.
But actually, it has added something.
I've seen people say that as well, that people have, enjoyed it. Look, if it's an optional thing, I think that's fine, but don't force it on people, because I think it's sort of... Ultimately, I think it's disrespectful to the fans who should be in the stadium, right?
Because it's the ultimate sort of reducing them to a product, basically, that they can inject or not.
Yeah.
And I agree with you there. I think, look, in an age of digital sort of red button technology, I mean, you've said many times you'd like commentary to be optional. So that surely should be optional too.
Yeah, yeah. And look, I mean, I'm just curious as to what it will be like for fans who watch all of their football, or certainly home games anyway, and I know there's people who go home and away, but watch their football inside the stadium, having to watch it in this weird state on television, and what sort of impact it might have on their relationship with the game or with the club or however it might be. I know that the lines are open, if you like, for people to get their season ticket refunds and everything else from today, the cashback facility that the club are providing. So that's an ongoing process. But it will be another thing that we're going to have to deal with, because, there's a slight worry, isn't there, that if the attempts to sort of manipulate the television viewing experience are successful. And if they sort of go down relatively well with people at home, what is to say that that won't influence the way football and sport is broadcast in the future? Like, I know that they already have, there's an element of sound design, if you like, from the broadcasters. You can turn up certain mics, you can turn down certain mics, but for the most part, you're getting this kind of authentic experience from within the stadium. But what's to say that, in an empty stadium or a half-empty stadium, when things come back, in the same way that commentary can influence our perception of a game because of the way they talk about it, what if the crowd noise can give you a different idea of a game? Or, I don't know, I just worry a little bit that they might then say, well, are the people who go to games really that important for the broadcasting experience?
Yeah, and I think a little bit of that already goes on. I mean, certainly if there's a Sky game in which fans chant against, fixtures being moved to accommodate TV schedules, that crowd noise disappears very, very quickly and is replaced by a kind of generic roar. And I think miking of different sections of fans can distort your feeling of, who can be heard. I mean, I think away fans are often mic'd to provide more balance, for example, in the broadcast. So there is a little bit of that already, and I share your concerns. And I also have great sympathy for people who love watching live football and who spend a great deal of their time doing that and travelling up and down the country. I mean, it's not going to be the same for them at all. I really sympathise with that. So, yeah, there's a lot that's going to feel odd about it. But like I say, that one game I watched from the Bundesliga sort of restored my feeling that if it was players out there who I was invested in and teams I was invested in, that I personally could, get something out of this.
Yeah.
I'm sure that won't be the case for everybody, because it's going to be a different product. But it's going to be case by case.
All right. Well, look, we will take a break here. We've done enough in part one. We're going to come back with your questions and more in part two, right after this.
Hey.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you know where we are.
I know where we are. This is part two? Yes.
Four.
Part nine. Part nine, where we do interpretive dance in relation to the questions that you ask us via your minds. So this is going
to
be
a fairly... It's not a great podcast format, to be honest.
Here, hang on. Here's my... Hang on. I'm going to do mine. What do you think?
That actually sounded pretty good.
Yeah, not bad, eh? Not bad. This is part two, where we answer questions that you send to us via Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog on the ArsBlog Facebook page, facebook.com/TheArsBlog, and on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. Before we get into the questions, James, I just have to read out winners of a competition that I did on the ArsCast last week. Not last week, the week before last. We had some copies of a book by Matt Spiro. It's called Sacre Bleu, Zidane to Mbappé, A Football Journey. And I forgot to give the answers and the winners on Friday's show because I'm quite forgetful. The random number generator did its thing, and the winners of the book are Claire Batas, Connor Whelan, John Hoskins, or Hawkins, where did I can't remember, Ben Fountain. I like people who've got, like, things as their surname.
Yeah,
like,
I agree.
Like Bob Spade or Trevor Ladle.
Absolutely. Ralph Spoon.
Yeah.
Etc.
Paolo Solari, I think. I've written these down and now I can't read my own handwriting. Do you know what's happened? In this lockdown, I've turned into a doctor. That's exactly what's happened.
What do you mean?
You ever get a prescription from a doctor, you can never read what they've written. Their handwriting is always so terrible.
Which you think is dangerous, really.
It sure
is. Be clear
is.
About what medicines people are taking.
Yes. The doctor says I'm to take 300 grams of cocaine every day.
Every single day.
Yes. Nick Andrews is the final winner. So well done to all of you guys, assuming I got your names right. I know the names in the emails anyway, so I will be on to you by email to get your name or to get your addresses, and the books will get sent out to you. So congratulations again. Right. Let's get on with questions. And there was a big story over the weekend about David Luiz and you know, his contract and all that kind of stuff. And we have some people asking Tokyo Gunner, who's at Tokyo_Gunner, and Arsnalovic, who want to know what are your thoughts on Kia Jarabchian denying the David Luiz transfer numbers in the article by Amy Lawrence, which was in The Athletic, which estimated that the total cost of the David Luiz transfer for one season for Arsenal was around the £24 million mark when you took into account transfer fee, intermediaries fees, wages, etc.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
For one season, yeah.
Even if you set aside any intermediaries fee, I think paying £8 million for a guy who's only going to play one season and who could potentially go for nothing at the end of it is a questionable thing to do. As for Kia denying that story, I suppose that it's to a certain extent inevitable. All I can say is that having known Amy a long time and worked with Amy a long time, she doesn't do news stories lightly. And, you know, I think we all know that she's someone who wouldn't say something unless she had very good cause to believe it. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me, though, that there's been a sort of public response to that. I think that, you know, that's inevitable, that kind of toing and froing.
Yeah, yeah. It is, I mean, it is a huge amount of money for one season for a player who, you know, at 33 years of age has got no resale value or anything like it. I mean, devil's advocate, people would say we were in a difficult situation because of the Lauren Koscielny thing. Yeah. You know, we had less...
And a weird position because... Because of the Saliba deal as well, it was kind of an odd situation where in some ways we almost needed a sticking plaster, you know?
Yeah, yeah, like an experienced centre-half to replace an experienced centre-half. Yeah. He has gone for some huge transfer fees, hasn't he, David Luiz?
Yeah, he's missed a deadline day, really, as a rule. I think he's moved from Benfica to Chelsea, Chelsea to PSG, back to Chelsea from PSG.
Mm.
And they've been... there can't be too many more expensive defenders in the history of football in terms of their cumulative transfer fees.
Yeah, Chelsea, Benfica to Chelsea, and these are fees listed by Transfermarkt. Benfica to Chelsea for 22 million. Then yeah. Chelsea to PSG... for 44.5 million, then yeah. PSG back to Chelsea for 31.5 million, and then to Arsenal on a one-year deal with an option for £8 million. So, yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, Chelsea did well out of that, didn't they? They sort of, you know, got the player back and made some money on it in the process. I think. What to say about it? I mean, setting aside the sort of agent's fee issue, what do you make of the dilemma that surrounds whether or not his contract should be extended?
It's an interesting one because we have two defenders in Sokratis and Shkodran Mustafi who, under normal circumstances, demand to be sold. You know, if we'd gone into this summer, both of them with 12 months left on their contract... both of them, because of their performance levels, should be sold because you need to get some money in to, you know, to replace them. I don't think either of them have been good enough. You know, I don't think Sokratis has been quite as bad as people have said, but certainly hasn't had a good time. And Mustafi, I know that people have sort of somehow forgotten the 3 years of Mustafi that happened before Mikel Arteta, 3.5 years of Mustafi that happened before Mikel Arteta took over and made him look reasonably competent again. But, you know, there'd be no way, based on the history of the player, that you would offer him a new deal. So you have to sell, or, you know, ordinarily you would have had to sell both of those players. And in those circumstances, you could probably make the case that Luiz, under Arteta, has been decent-ish. He's been okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
You know, he's certainly a lot better than he was when he was playing for a coach he didn't like. And I know the whole Emery thing had an impact on all the players and all the performance levels.
One of the interesting things about Luiz is that I think he's a pretty good leader. And when you want a manager out, in the history of his career, he has led a lot of those efforts on the player's behalf.
That's not necessarily the kind of leadership that most clubs are looking for, though.
No. But when he is content and happy, I mean, I actually think that the sort of tricky thing with Luiz is that as good as he's been on the pitch, I have the sense that he has been a very valuable lieutenant to Arteta.
Yeah, well, I think in general he's a popular guy in the squad. He seems like a very, very nice man. You know, I remember when we were signing him and I was like, oh, Jesus Christ, David Luiz, I can't really believe we're doing this. But, you know, we needed a defender and everything else. And I remember watching the video of his first day at Arsenal and arriving to do his medical and everything else. And he just seemed like a really nice guy, very humble, didn't come with any airs or graces or anything like that. And I think he has been quite useful to some of the younger players in the squad, particularly Gabriel Martinelli, you know, the Brazilian connection. So, you know, like I said, in normal circumstances, if you could sell Mustafi and Sokratis, you could make a good case for extending Luiz's contract.
But do you think the issue is that there's not going to be a buyer for those two?
I think it's going to be very difficult to find a buyer for those two. And the other thing that you have to bear in mind is, let's say you're Socrates and you're at Arsenal on 100 grand a week or whatever it might be. And let's say you're Shkodran Mustafi and you're at Arsenal on 100 grand a week, more or less. You know, remember, he was a £35 million signing. And those, you know, those transfer fees aren't just big transfer fees. They inform the salary level as well. So an agent is going to say, well, if you're prepared to pay £35 million for my client, you know, and at that time, it was a pretty substantial fee. I think he was like the sixth most expensive defender of all time in the Premier League, or maybe higher than that when he signed. You know, you're not going to come in on a pittance in terms of wages. So if I'm those guys, and I'm Socrates and I'm 31, how old is Socrates? 31?
I think he must be at least that. Yeah,
he's 31
for another week.
For another week, yes. He's going to be 32 on the 9th of June. But until then, he, of course, remains 31 because that's how it works. Mustafi is a bit younger. But if I'm both of those guys, I'm looking at the financial impact of the COVID-19 crisis on football and football clubs and their ability to pay wages. I mean, we have a situation with Mohamed Elneny, who's owed money by Besiktas, and there's a big dispute there. So, you know, if you're those guys and you look to move, or you're open to moving this summer, what are you moving to? And what kind of financial package can you expect from the club that you move to? If we're assuming that both of those guys would get a move to, let's say, a mid-tier European club, something like that?
Sure.
That'd be not unreasonable.
In the past, it was certainly the case that in these moves, footballers never lost money.
Mm-hmm.
So if they were going to take a pay cut, theoretically, to go and play in the Bundesliga or whatever it might be, they would ensure that they got what they were owed, effectively.
Yeah.
So the club would have to pay them some compensation that covered the remainder of their contract. Something like that.
Yeah. So now, are you going to move? Are you going to move if you're going to get a pay cut, or are you going to see out the final year of your contract and earn your wages as you're perfectly entitled to do? I have a feeling it's going to be very, very difficult to move players that we previously would have wanted to move. And if we need to take a chunk off the wage bill, then not taking up the option on Luiz is maybe an easier way to do it.
Well, let's put it in this context. I think the 12.5% pay cut that the squad took, how much do we think that saved the club a year? About 30 million quid?
About 24 million, I think, is what we came up with.
So the Athletic story yesterday said that Luiz was paid approximately 10 million per season.
Mm.
And that aspect of the story has not been challenged in any way thus far. So kind of incredible that Arsenal could save themselves almost half what they got by getting everyone to take a pay cut just by shedding Luiz. And that might be in their thoughts, you know, given that you've got a guy like Mesut Ozil on 350 grand a week who you couldn't get to break that contract previously, you've got absolutely zero chance of doing that now. You've also got probably the second highest paid player at the club is Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. His situation, I think, who knows what's going to happen with that. There's talk in France and Italy today that Arsenal are talking about a contract extension with him. So you might be committing to that salary in the long term. You're certainly in a position where you might be committed to it for the next 12 months.
Yeah.
Because the buyers who might have been there for him may be thinking, I'll just get him for free in a year. He still looks like he's in decent shape.
Yeah.
So given some of these commitments, I can understand why they're looking at Luiz, and they're also looking at how many centre-halves they've got. I mean, you know, Mavropanos out on loan, Callum Chambers out injured. We mentioned Mustafi, we mentioned Socrates. Pablo Marie is a very doable deal, relatively cheap too. Saliba's coming back. It's probably more that I'm forgetting.
Mavropanos.
Yeah, exactly. So I can see why they might think about letting him go. If I was making a decision from a purely footballing perspective, he's absolutely not the one that I would lose, you know? And I don't think he'd be number one on Mikel Arteta's list to lose either.
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, if you were to be brutally honest, and I'll be brutally honest here, I wouldn't be unhappy to lose all three of them. But if I had to keep one of the three, I think in the short term I'd prefer to keep Luiz than either Socrates or certainly Mustafi.
Yeah, and he does, Luiz, for all his flaws, he does kind of have, you know, his ability on the ball is pretty great. It's sort of a superpower, you know, and it enables us to do things in terms of in possession that we might not otherwise be able to do. If there's any way we could shed some of the less good ones and keep one of the more good ones, I would prefer that. But I do think that we probably have to sort of, we have to kind of give the club, what can I say? Not the benefit of the doubt, but I think we have to accept that decisions are going to be made maybe slightly more on a financial basis than we would ideally like. And that is the reality of every business right now.
No, I think that's fair. I think that's absolutely fair that perhaps sporting consideration won't be the first thing that informs the way we build our squad or assemble our squad ahead of next season. That there are going to have to be financial influences, I guess, you know? So, look, I'm not envious of anyone having to do it, by the way, but, you know, it's a tricky situation and we'll see what they come up with.
We will. This question kind of touches on a similar thing. It's from Jamie Kafash on Twitter. And Jamie says, Arseblog has been very critical of our transfer dealings under Raul. However, if we had signed Martinelli and Saliba, two of the hottest youngsters in the world, under Mislintat, wouldn't this have been hailed as a bit of Sven magic?
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair question. We still haven't seen Saliba yet. You know, there's a huge look. I hope he's as fucking brilliant as all the articles say he is. I hope he's as full of potential and promise as the transfer fee suggests, and the sort of hoops that we went through to get him. But we haven't seen him yet, and it's a lot to put on a 19-year-old defender. We can't say if the Saliba deal had been done by Sven, we'd be hailing it as magic yet, because we can't see that it is anything at this moment in time. So I'm sort of a bit cautious about that one. Martinelli, you know, for me, one of the big positives of the season. I think it's a great coup, a really good transfer. We know that it was put in place by the man who is now basically our head scout, Francis Cadjigal, who, if people listen to the podcast with Cesc a few weeks back, you know, was responsible for finding him as well. So, you know, it was a great deal. It was a great deal. And the impact he's had this season has obviously been very significant. And he's a very, very exciting talent. It doesn't mean that there aren't questions to ask about some of the deals that we've done, some of the other deals that we've done. And it certainly doesn't wipe away questions we might have about some of the departures and what have you. But, yeah, fair question overall.
You wrote a good blog this morning that's worth reading if you're one of those people who listens to the pod but doesn't read the blog. It's a really good one about kind of Raul Senyehi's tenure at the club. And I do think it raises really important questions about kind of responsibility and what's the word I'm thinking of? Accountability.
Yes.
You know, and where the buck stops on certain decisions. There have been strange things. I mean, one thing that I thought was strange at the time and that I continue to think is strange and kind of never really gets talked about is, for example, selling Nacho Monreal for pittance, basically, at a time when he was really quite a useful player still. And Unai Emery cited it, didn't he, in his Guardian interview. But, you know, that was just a sort of odd, an odd example of kind of losing someone for next to nothing when they were actually under contract, albeit over 30. And I also think that Raul, unfortunately, made a bit of a cross for his own back in some ways with his statement about not letting players run down contracts. You know, this idea that two years out they would sign or be sold. I know that when that was said, a lot of people in football raised eyebrows, because while it is a noble intention, it is much, much easier said than done. And Arsenal have failed to do it quite significantly. And the situation with Ramsey and Welbeck going for nothing was obviously disastrous. But we're talking now about, and granted the general financial landscape hasn't helped things, but a whole heap more players potentially leaving in that situation.
Yes, I mean, I feel like that is one of the big black marks over San Yehi and his tenure as head of football, director of football, whatever you want to call it. You know, he is calling the shots from a footballing perspective. Gazidis is gone. Mislintat is gone. He assumed the power. You know, he was appointed head of football. And I know Vinay was made managing director. But one of the first things that he said when he came into the job was, we have to manage player contracts better. We cannot allow situations where players are going into the final 12 months of their contracts. And I realized that to an extent, he inherited the Ramsey situation and the Welbeck situation. Nevertheless, you know, he said they made a mistake when it came to Ramsey. They could have made decisions on those players in the summer of 2018. I know it would have been a big upheaval, but ultimately, would it not have been better for Arsenal to raise money in the transfer market by selling those two players? And now we're in a situation where Aubameyang is in the final year of his contract. Socrates, Mustafi, nobody's crying too many tears, but, you know, it's still a situation which has left us with the problems that we discussed just a few minutes ago because of this, the lockdown and the transfer market. And, you know, nobody could have predicted that, but it's still a consequence of allowing the contracts to get to that situation. You know, Mesut Ozil, another one, perhaps we're happy to let it run out because there was really no other way of dealing with it. But what about, you know, Aubameyang? What about Saka? You know, these are things that are happening that he said should not happen, and they continue to happen. And you've got to raise questions about our ability to manage those situations.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it is possible. I was thinking about this before the podcast and I was like, well, maybe the way to approach it is to sort of go into bat for Raul a bit, you know, to play devil's advocate, to make that an interesting dynamic. Because I think the transfer activity last summer is a really tricky one, because it does feel to me like, as a fan base, our assessment of the business has vacillated quite a lot since it was done. And I know that's inevitable because it's based on performance, but it feels to me like, you know, Pepe was hailed as a great coup at the time. And then, okay, he doesn't quite hit the ground running. Then that gets reassessed. Luiz, it got us out of a hole late in the day. I mean, certainly you can think under the previous stewardship of the club with Arsene and Dick Law and others, I can imagine that is a deal we wouldn't have done, you know, that we might have needed that experience at half, but given the outlay we required, said we're not going to do it, for better or worse. Mm. So I think
we might have done something else.
We might, but there were plenty of times we didn't.
Yeah. You know? Or would the Koscielny situation have developed that way? I mean,
yeah,
it's not like
possibly
it,
not.
It's not like it didn't happen with certain players, but generally it was younger players.
Yeah, possibly not. Mm. I think that's fair. But I think what I mean is, the day after transfer deadline day, people were happy with those signings, I think. I think at the end of the window, people were looking at that and going, we had a good window. And so I think that's sort of the only mitigation, is that, like, some of the things that happened in terms of the team not then performing, it's kind of like, well, that's on Unai to an extent.
Mm.
And but then, of course, you've got the caveat of, well, maybe Unai should have been out the door quicker. So it's a difficult argument to mount, is what I'm saying. Like, I've sort of tried to intellectually get my head around it. And I do have, I'm not going to say sympathy, but I do understand some of the decisions that Rao's made. But a lot of them haven't worked, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's okay to think one thing and then in 6 months' time when there's evidence or more information available to you to change your mind. You know, it's not that you were wrong in the first place. It's that, you know, you can make a decision. And like you say, sometimes they just don't work. And that can happen in football. It's, you know, happens on a weekly basis in terms of team selection sometimes. So, you know, we're not, it's not as if everybody's expected to be perfect. But I think you can just have an overall look at what's happened at the club and the way that football performance has been affected overall under Raul's tenure and wonder if it stands up to a great deal of scrutiny. But look, if people want to read that piece, they can do that today. Just visit the website arsblog.com and you will see the article there. Here's a question. This comes from Jesus. Okay, comes from Ali. Sorry, Ali, I didn't mean to say Jesus there. Like it was, I just couldn't find it. I couldn't find the question and then I found it straight away. And they say, I've lost it again. Fuck. Okay. Hi, gents. Ahead of the Premier League returning on June 17th, it would be great if you could do a brief recap of Arteta's tenure to date. A reminder of tactics, approach, positives, negatives, etc. would be great. I seem to have pretty much forgotten everything in the lockdown. So here you go.
Arsenal. I mean, wow. We've admitted in part one, we don't know. But let's have a go, eh?
Mm.
So the first game for Mikel Arteta, the first game he was in the stands was the Everton game, which was an absolutely diabolical match. I don't know if you remember it at all.
I do.
It was the kind of the one where Freddie, I think he dropped Ozil and played a lot of kids.
Smith Rowe started that game, did he?
Smith Rowe started, yeah. And then Mikel took charge on Boxing Day against Bournemouth. And he had to wait for his first win. He drew at Bournemouth. He lost in relatively unfortunate circumstances against Chelsea, as I recall. Arsenal started brilliantly but couldn't maintain it. And then they got that win over Manchester United. And that was sort of what kick-started Arteta's reign. And I think I'm right in saying,
apart from Olympiacos, we haven't lost a game since.
Right. So domestically, we haven't. And that's probably the high point, isn't it? The United game still? I don't think we've surpassed that.
No, I mean, I think in terms of pure performance, you could look at the second half against Newcastle. You know, I know we scored a couple of late goals, which added some gloss to the scoreline. I think that there was an issue, wasn't there, where we were trying to find a balance between defensive stability and attacking potency. And for a while, it had to be a bit more weighted towards the defence. And I think it did come at the expense of some of our attacking ability because we needed to sort out the defensive side of the team, which I think he did to a large extent.
But I think you're right. I mean, we are shot. Our chance creation, as a rule, is down there. I mean, we're not creating huge numbers of chances. We are conceding less shots on goal too. So basically, if we go right back to the start of the season, the kind of end-to-end chaos basketball games like the one at Vicarage Road that we had under Emery, it's been a much more controlled Arsenal that we've seen under Arteta. One that has much better positioning on the pitch. I think that's been one of the big changes under him.
Yeah.
And there have been, until now, certain hallmarks of that shape. And I suppose they would be, you know, Granit Xhaka, for example, playing in central midfield but dropping in as almost an auxiliary fullback, allowing particularly the left-back to push on very high. The right-back, until now, in the Arteta team, has played in a more conservative, narrow fashion. I mean, we've even seen Socrates out there, haven't we, on games where Bellerin's not been available.
Yeah, don't need any more of that when football gets back. Thank you.
So, you know, there's been debate about that, about the kind of asymmetry of it and the degree to which it leaves Pepe a little isolated at times. But equally, I think that maybe Arteta seems to think that if you play Pepe, he doesn't offer you enough going the other direction, so you have to take steps to prevent that. And then in attack, it's been very much this kind of 2-3-5 or 3-2-5 shape, with Saka pushing on, Ozil, and then almost five across the front, you know, with Aubameyang as a kind of narrow inside forward, Lacazette, whose form was being pretty much bemoaned, I think some of it justifiably, before football went away, kind of holding down the centre forward spot. And then Aubameyang, Ozil kind of on the inside right channel, and then Pepe on the right. But actually, Lacazette had just sort of started to be pulled out of the team, and Nketiah had started a couple of Premier League games, hadn't he? And there was maybe the slight sense that Arteta was going to have a proper look at Nketiah between then and the end of the season.
I think. That's interesting. I'd forgotten about that sort of side of things. And I think there was an element to which we could see that the players were buying into what Arteta was doing, you know, on the training ground. I know there's this sort of new manager bounce, and everybody was probably found it refreshing to be communicated to in a way which connected with them, which I don't think was the case under Emery.
Also, there was this slight sense of players coming in from the cold. I mean, Xhaka, let's obviously not forget what happened with him, and the armband had become quite important to Arteta. Mustafi, another. And I think even Dani Ceballos, who was not in contention at all when Arteta first came in, wasn't like left out of squads. I think by the time football stopped, had kind of, I'm not going to say established himself, but maybe edged in front of certain others as the partner for Xhaka.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. He had been injured, of course, which was a part of it. But I think Arteta was quite direct, wasn't he? And he has been about, you know, Ceballos. He asked to get fit, or whatever it was that he said about Ceballos. He really put it up to him, and Ceballos responded. I think Arteta said he's training like an animal. And similarly, didn't he have words about Pepe, you know, in terms of his, what he expected from him. So he hasn't been slow to sort of talk about players in set public stands to try and get more from them.
Maitland-Niles is maybe an example of someone who that hasn't worked out as well for. You know, he seems to have fallen away from contention a bit. I think the other sort of subplot that was just about starting to develop was at centre-back, and what, you know, could you play Pablo Marie one side and David Luiz the other, and have a bit more of an expansive passing range out of centre half. I think that was a sort of conversation that was happening around the time. Okay. But the reason that it's interesting is that I think many people had the impression that the way Arsenal were playing under Arteta was kind of a consequence of the fact that he came into the team with no pre-season, with limited knowledge of the players he had at his disposal, injuries to certain key personnel, like Tierney, for example, Bellerin and others, and that he was kind of making the best of a certain situation. And maybe there was he saw the value in having a consistent shape and a consistent setup so that he could try and establish some patterns of play.
Yeah.
And now that he has sort of got a little bit of a mini pre-season, it will be very interesting, won't it, to see to what degree those tropes continue.
Like I said, it's sort of blank slate time again. I'm very excited about what we're going to do, and whether the lockdown, I mean, we'd said before, didn't we, about Arteta, that it was essentially a free hit for him, a free 5-6 months when he took over, because the expectations and the situation we were in lent itself to that. You know, we were in the doldrums. Whatever he was able to achieve between then and the end of the season would have been okay, you know, assuming it didn't go completely terribly. But now I wonder if there's going to be a bit more of an element of needing to put in place the things that we're going to do next season, and the idea that we might, and we won't be the only club by any stretch of the imagination to do this, which is focus on youth as a way of replenishing your squad and rebuilding your squad rather than the transfer market. Is there just a little bit more of an impetus now to give those young players chances in the remaining games that we have?
Yeah, and sometimes I think about sort of the winners and the losers. It's a horrible way to put it, I apologise, but from the sort of recent crisis in football terms. And I think of a guy like Joe Willock, for example, who I think certain people looked at and thought, well, you know, is he ready to play for Arsenal? Is he ever going to be ready to play for Arsenal? But now, given the limitations on spending and, you know, what we might be able to do in the transfer market, I think suddenly, you know, there is more of a clear path and a need for him to be around. And I think that, yeah, it will definitely work in the favour of the academy players we've got coming through. And again, makes it all the more essential that we hold on to the very best of them.
Mm. Okay, have you got a question?
Yes, I do. This is from Twitter. It's from Simon at Simon Weiss. And Simon says, when will the club arrive in the 21st century and appoint further, i.e. younger, board members that could steer the club in the right direction? And I thought this was a good question as a jumping off point to the discussion about the chairman and the board.
Well, I mean, I don't know, to be perfectly honest. I don't know. I mean, there was a suggestion that they wanted David O'Leary to join the board. But the board, as we know it, or knew it, is gone, dead and buried. Sir Chips has retired, and we're not going to replace him. We're not going to replace the role of chairman, as far as I know. We have...
It's a four-man board now of Stan, Josh, Ken Fryer, and Lord Harris.
Right. So that's a, you know, Stan and Josh are basically the two guys.
Yeah. I mean, look, Ken Fryer's a really significant figure at Arsenal, and almost out of respect for him, do you know what I mean? Mm. You're not going to dismantle the board entirely.
Yeah.
But in terms of real authority and power, it's just with Stan and Josh. And then
the football executive committee. So the question you would have to ask is, do we have enough expertise? Do we have enough knowledge? You know, is there enough work for the guys that are there? You know, we've got Ralph Sinyehi, obviously, is head of football. Edu is our technical director. Husfami is the contracts guy and does a bit more behind the scenes as well. Are they going?
Yeah.
Per Mertesacker, of course, yeah. But after that, and I'm sure Mikel Arteta has, you know, an input into certain aspects of the way the football club is being run, and you would hope with the recruitment. But what are they going to do? I mean, are they going to bring in a young person to do what? For what? You know, for what role? Are they going to appoint somebody to provide, like, if I was Stan and Josh Kroenke, I wouldn't necessarily appoint somebody to the football executive committee itself. Mm. If I was confident that the expertise that we have to run the football club is there. So you got your technical director, you got your head of football, you got your head of recruitment, you got your head of scouting, you've got your head of the academy and all those things. If you believe those pieces are all in place, you wouldn't create a role just to create a role, just to add somebody to it. I would, if it were me, unquestionably add somebody to executive level with oversight of everything that goes on at a football level. Somebody who could assess the performance of all the people in their particular roles, just to see, you know, how good of a job are they doing? What exactly are they doing? You know, what is happening? How is it happening? And within the business plan, within the strategy of the football club, I would have somebody who had oversight, who reported directly to me as the 100% owner of the football club.
interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, Josh is, I think, in theory, that person, but he's a man with a lot on his plate.
Yeah. Right, he's got the Denver Nuggets.
The McNuggets. it's a really interesting one, and I thought that the timeline of Tim Payton, who obviously has been a spokesperson for the AST in the past, was interesting in terms of the sense of the board are there in part to sort of provide a check, you know, on the decisions made by the executive committee. I mean, the removal of the board as a sort of going concern or as an authority within the club grants more power indirectly to the executives. And it places more responsibility on KSE to kind of monitor that.
Yeah.
And I don't even mean this as a slight against KSE, but they have a lot of teams, you know?
Mm.
And so they can't necessarily be... And I think that is sort of what the David O'Leary thing was intended as.
Yeah.
But there was a bit of resistance there. So, yeah, I mean, I think as well it's slightly... It's a bit of a shame on the tradition front. I mean, the reason this is happening is that Arsenal is now a privately owned club, so there is not really a need for a board. The buck stops with one man or two men, one family, let's put it like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it is a departure for the club and a bit of a it feels a little bit odd to me. That's all.
Yes.
Just as someone who's grew up with the club operating.
Sure, yeah. I mean, look, it's a testament to the world that we live in now and the fact that the ownership, you know, has changed in such a considerable way over the last, you know, 5-10 years at Arsenal. You know,
and I say that recognising that not many fans will mourn Sir Chip.
Sure, yeah.
He pissed a lot of people off, you know.
Sure. I mean, at the heart of it, though, he was an Arsenal fan.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So there is just a slight difference, you know, when it comes to KSE and Stan and Josh. But, you know, I think if I was in charge of a business worth £2 billion, I would most definitely have some independent auditors looking at every aspect of that business. And maybe they do. Maybe I'm completely wrong about this. And maybe that's something that they would do as a matter of course. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know who that person is at the football club. They would need to be there, you know, right now. So I don't know that role necessarily exists. It might exist within the KSE organization. And it's not necessarily an Arsenal employee. So who knows? Okay, here's a couple of questions from the Discord. One comes from Cesar, who says, who do you think is going to be the first player to score for Arsenal after this long break? Then we've got one from Wise Marklar, who says, who is going to be the most entertaining player to listen to on the pitch?
Yeah, I liked that question. Who's going to score? Aubameyang, he's the only one who scores. I think that one's quite easy. Unless you have an alternative theory.
I like a bit of a long shot. So
Come on then.
I'm going to go with...
David Luiz free kick.
No, that's never
worth every
happen.
Penny. Okay.
I am gonna say Granite Xhaka.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, just for the hell of it. I mean, it is probably gonna be Aubameyang, but like, fuck it.
Who's gonna be the most interesting to listen to? Well. I mean, I doubt we're the most vocal. You know, certainly a lot of our players aren't especially. I think Luiz is one who you probably will hear. I think Xhaka is another voice you will hear.
Are we not slightly more inclined or more likely, rather, to hear from players playing in wide areas than we are?
Because of mics.
Yeah, because of microphones.
Very possibly. I mean, I think what will be really interesting is hearing Arteta. And I think that you will hear a lot of Mikel Arteta because he talks non-stop through a game.
Yeah.
On the pitch, I mean, who have you got on the flanks? Pepe doesn't really speak. Aubameyang barely does. I think if he has to talk to the referee as captain, he will do. But he's not a guy who is particularly vocal. I think maybe Hector. Because you've got the added bonus with Hector of the accent.
Yeah.
The brilliant accent.
Could be a good one. Yeah, I was going to say Bellerin. And a final one from the Discord from Ace Aurenius. I think that's how you pronounce it. Mm. Says, any predictions on which Arsenal players will thrive in Project Restart football, considering their strengths, etc.? For example, Mesut Ozil will be able to use his vision being an inherent skill to find opportunities and space loosened up during gameplay due to the opposition's lack of training and, you know, not being fully fit.
Interesting. I think, at the risk of being boring, I'm going to say Aubameyang again because he is such an extraordinary athlete, and I think he'll find his level maybe quicker than some others. And if you're a little bit less sharp than normal, I think Aubameyang will punish you for it. I also have it's less to do with a specific skill, but like you, I have a slight hunch for Reece Nelson in what remains of the season. I just feel like maybe an opportunity is there for him. And given the amount of games we'll have to play, some inevitable rotation, I know that Mikel Arteta really believes in him and has given him some increased confidence. And we all actually know how much ability he does have. You know, anybody who saw him play at academy level, nobody questions the talent that Reece Nelson had. And if he can find a way to express it consistently, you know, he hasn't exploded onto the scene like a Jadon Sancho. But let me tell you, 3 years ago, people were talking about those people like equivalent talents. And Sancho is now a £100 million player, whatever it might be. Now, it's not no guarantee Nelson will ever get there, but there is a lot of unexplored potential with him. And I think I just have the sense that he might be a bit of a pet project for Arteta. Yeah. So, yeah, what about you?
I think it's a reasonable point about Ozil, but it's sort of dependent on the rest of the teammates being able to, you know, get on his wavelength and also exploit the lack of fitness by the opposition. It just strikes me as well that maybe goalkeepers goalkeepers need to practice, or should they be okay? I mean, they don't have the same kind of physical involvement in a game that, you know, a central midfielder does. So I wonder, would it be easier for them to get back to their full level, because they can do a lot of work on the reflexes and the sharpness in training, and it's not as if they've got to sort of run 10, 11 kilometres a game. So
yeah, the lungs don't have to quite get back to the same capacity. I mean, the only thing I'd say about goalkeepers is I guess when we were in proper lockdown, while an outfield player can go for a run, it's probably quite difficult for a goalkeeper to keep their reflexes sharp.
Just all they need is three oranges.
Right, and they just juggle.
Just juggle. That's how you do it.
I think that's what Leno was probably doing. Mm. I mean, in seriousness, I wonder if there is a bit of tech. Like, you know, with tennis players, the ball cannon. I wonder if that exists within football, that you can get shots fired at you sort of automatically.
Yeah, there is, isn't there?
There must be.
I'm pretty sure there is.
The problem is all the coaches like taking the outfield shots themselves, right? Because it's fun.
We just fire the coaches because we have to pay them wages and we replace them with machines. You remember, you know those like you know those scary Boston Dynamic dog robot things that can, you know, even if you hit it with a baseball bat, it just sort of flips over and keeps walking at you, or you cut off one of its legs and it keeps walking at you, or it can open doors or climb tables or, you know, run up sheer mountain faces. Those terrifying robot things just move into the whole ball cannon sphere, and they'll make a fortune from football clubs who want to let humans go because they have to pay them money. You just have to put a little bit of you know, petrol or electricity in the robot, whatever it is, batteries, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great idea, actually. In these economically stretched times, let's invest in robots.
Let's invest in robots. I've got one more before we go. This has been a long part two, so let's just do one more.
Oh, I've got one more
go on then.
Mine is about Saliba, because people keep asking about when can Saliba play. For example, Sonny Cool on the Discord. His contract with St Etienne, his loan contract, runs until the end of June. So he will stay with them until then, at least. He won't be eligible to play in the Premier League this season. But I expect efforts will be made to have him join up as early as possible so he can kind of acclimatise.
Yeah. Final question then. It comes from Daniel, who's at Danino58 on Twitter. He says, I was having a discussion with a friend who said it will be weird when football returns indoors. I said, it's behind closed doors and not indoors. They then said, all football is played indoors, to which I said, even enclosed stadiums have a roof, which makes it outdoors. Discuss.
I don't understand the last point. Enclosed stadiums have a roof.
Yeah, so even if...
outdoors.
Yeah. So even, like, let's say the Cardiff Arms Park. Now, what's it called? Millennium Stadium?
Yeah. Has that got a retractable
roof? That's got a retractable roof.
If the roof is retractable, then it's outdoors.
If you were to go into a building and it was surrounded on all sides and there was a door out to, like, a courtyard, you would say that was an indoor courtyard, would you not?
No, I'd say that was a square building with an outdoor...
with an outdoor middle.
An outdoor interior.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a lot of monasteries and stuff are built like that, aren't they? It's where there's kind of a
football pitch.
Yeah,
in the middle.
Football pitch. Yeah. So what do you... I think football stadiums are outside.
Well, the buildings themselves are, but is the interior, is the inside of a football stadium outside? I mean, you walk out onto the pitch, but it is within a structure. So it's an interior, indoor... Doesn't work, really, does it?
So, these matches will be behind some closed doors... But some of those doors will be open. Otherwise, you can't get to the pitch.
Yeah. You can't get from indoors in the stadium to the outdoors pitch, you see.
Unless they are going to, like, helicopter people down onto the pitch so that all the doors remain closed.
Bit of razzmatazz.
Yeah, they arrive by helicopter in full kit and then depart in the same way at full time.
Just hang on to a rope.
Yeah, that would be good, wouldn't it?
That would be good. Yeah.
A bit scary, though. I think I think a football pitch is in its outside indoors.
Perfect. We've got it sorted. We've got it sorted. Okay, well, look, thank you to everybody for listening. Wherever you are, I hope you're safe and well and doing okay. We appreciate you being here as always. We'll have some stuff midweek, I think, and of course we'll have another Arscast on Friday. Until then, we'll catch you on the next one.
Bye bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.